You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. Joining me on the line is Rabbi Sue Levi Elwell of the URJ, the Union for Reform Judaism, the largest Jewish movement in North America, representing about 1.5 million Jews. Rabbi Elwell is a worship specialist and is also on the board of directors of Rabbis for Human Rights North America. Thanks for joining us today, Rabbi.
Thank you.
Rabbi, can I call you Sue?
Fine.
Sue, first let me ask you, exactly what is a rabbi and how is it that a person could be designated one?
Rabbi means teacher, and since ancient times, those who have demonstrated and immersed themselves in Jewish learning have been honored by their communities by being called Rav, or teacher. Nowadays, we actually go to seminary, and the seminary process is actually a fairly new thing, less than 200 years old, but there are a number of seminaries in America and in Europe and Israel across the world that ordain rabbis. So different seminaries, of course, have different standards, and some are connected with particular movements of Judaism, and others train folks to serve in all aspects of Jewish life. But most seminaries require their students to have completed a baccalaureate degree before entering, and the programs vary in length, but usually they're 4 to 6 to 7 years of postgraduate study. And immersion in text study and learning, we usually have to have a pretty good command of the Hebrew language when we enter, because all of our traditional texts are in Hebrew or Aramaic, which is an ancient precursor of the Hebrew language. And we spend our time, you know, learning our tradition. We never complete the learning, but we complete the course of study and then enter into the world to serve in one way or another. And rabbis do all kinds of things. We serve in hospitals as chaplains. We serve in schools working with both children and college students. We serve in a variety of institutions of higher learning. Some of us are college professors, and many of us serve congregations in North America, South America, and across the world. It's a life work that many of us consider it a calling, and it's work that is always challenging intellectually and spiritually. And in the best situations, rabbis have an opportunity to grow throughout their lives, because we're constantly both working with individuals, with families, with communities, and we're also interacting with an extraordinary library of texts that for us are living, breathing entities in themselves. So we continue to discover new things about the world in which we live because of the insights of those who came before us.
How long have you been a rabbi?
This June, I will be celebrating 25 years.
Mm-hmm. And is it as simple as saying that there's a Christian or a Muslim counterpart to a rabbi?
In many ways, of course, yes, because we are pastors and we are community leaders. And those of us who do interfaith work feel, I'll speak for myself, I always feel very blessed to work with others who have taken on the mantle of leadership in their religious communities. But, you know, the training, of course, is very specific to our individual communities, and there are differences. But at the end of the day, I think that those of us who are part of a religious community or have been blessed to be born into one or who choose one are always particularly enriched if we have the opportunity to work with or be accompanied by someone whose life is about service. So that would be true of people of any background who are looking for a pastor, a chaplain, a counselor who is steeped in religious tradition. And of course, that person does not have to be formally ordained. There are many talented folks who serve in that capacity without formal ordination. But in my tradition, we have formal ordination to acknowledge those who serve in this way.
What is a worship specialist, Sue?
I work for the Union for Reform Judaism, and we serve over 900 congregations in North America. And my job, I have the great pleasure of working with congregations to help them keep their worship healthy. And I have the opportunity to speak with congregational leaders, both professional leaders and lay leaders, about what is the nature of spiritual health in a congregation. And part of that is worship, but it's not only. So I define worship in a very broad way in my position as worship specialist. It's really about the entire health of the congregation in terms of how we treat each other, how we look at the world, how engaged we are with the world, how we become sufficiently spiritually healthy that we can be of service to the larger community. And so it's not just about what prayers we use, although one of my great pleasures is learning about and teaching liturgy, which is always changing and growing. We're in the holiday of Hanukkah right now, so when we bless the Hanukkah lights, there are some prayers that I say that have been said for many centuries. There are some tunes that we sing that have been developing over many centuries, and then there are new blessings that some of us innovate as well with great pleasure and delight. And part of the challenge of worship is to see what lasts. What are we using this year that we'll use again next year and that our children will love? And what have we tried to innovate that doesn't really work and that our grandchildren will look and get wonderfully quizzical, delicious looks on their faces and say, our grandparents did that. Mm-hmm. And so being a worship specialist means that I think a lot about the past and a lot about the future.
Now, since you mentioned that it is Hanukkah right now, I want you to tell our listeners, give them a brief background of what Hanukkah is and what it celebrates.
We are in the darkest time of year, and so we are in a time when many traditions say we need to kindle lights. There are many Hanukkah stories about political victory and re-sanctification of holy space that had been taken over by those who did not support the Israelite tradition that was developing. Hanukkah in America has really come to be an opportunity for families to gather, to kindle lights together, and to think about what makes family and what makes community. And in the broadest sense, Hanukkah is about kindling lights, and we have a special 8-branched menorah with actually an extra lighting candle. There are 8 candles and then another candle that's used to kindle the 8 candles, and we increase the light. So on the very first night, there are actually 2 candles, the shamash, as it is called, the one that lights the candle. So there are 2 lights, and then every night we increase. So the brightest night for some is the last night, the 8th night. And this year, very unusually and rarely, the nights of Hanukkah coincide with the Gregorian calendar. So the first night of Hanukkah was December 1st, so every night we know exactly how many candles to light because it's also the...
Right, the day, right, sure.
But this is a rarity. I wanted a friend to check and see when else this has ever happened. We don't go by this calendar. I mean, we do, of course. You know, I live in the world. But we also have a lunar solar calendar, and Hanukkah begins on the 25th day of the month of Kislev. And so that's why it actually, quote-unquote, moved, and that some years it can start as early as November, and some years it will actually spill over into January. So like our Muslim cousins for whom Ramadan moves around the calendar, we have some movement in our holidays as well.
Is Rabbis for Human Rights Israel the main entity?
Rabbis for Human Rights Israel is an organization that was founded a little over 20 years ago, I should have the date in front of me, by rabbis from several different strains or traditions of Judaism to bring to bear the deep and longtime teachings of our tradition on a very complicated political situation in our beloved Israel. So that organization has been thriving for a number of years, and Rabbis for Human Rights North America was founded in the last decade to be a supportive organization and to partner with our colleagues and comrades in Israel, and also to use the same idea of bringing the wisdom of our tradition, a very strong history of fair treatment for all, and making sure that we're applying that in America as Americans and Canadians, but particularly America. We call it North America, but most of our work actually is American issues. So over the years, we've taken up some very specific American issues, particularly the issue of torture. We have worked in interfaith coalitions with other folks of other religions who have said that torture, particularly as practiced in Guantanamo and other American prisons, is against our deep belief that all humans are created in God's image and should be accorded honor and respect because of that essential equality of our creation. We are working on a range of issues in addition to that, as well as American Jews who believe that our text continues to speak to us and gives us a mandate to be engaged in some of the very tough issues with which all Americans struggle.
The issues that you were alluding to, besides torture, also slavery and the situation in the Gaza Strip, is that right?
The domestic issues that we're looking at are slavery and human trafficking. We're looking at the issue of indefinite detention, which is, of course, connected to torture here in the U.S. And we are looking at a range of human rights issues in the Gaza Strip, in East Jerusalem, and in Israel as a whole. We face some really difficult issues there that our colleagues and compatriots are working on. Freedom of access is a very serious issue. Universal health care is, that seems to be a worldwide problem. One of the sessions that we will have at the conference, we have a specialist from Israel who's been working on the lack of access to health care by many Arab citizens of Israel, for instance. We're looking at a wide range of issues that are problematic for human health and human life, both in Israel and here in America.
Does your organization share some of the beliefs of Netarai Karta?
No, they're pretty much the opposite of us.
Okay.
that's an organization that does not believe that there should be a state of Israel. And we, as Rabbis for Human Rights, understand the importance of a state that has laws that protect citizens and also believes deeply in the imperative of having a just state. One of the sessions we'll be having at the conference helps people to read the Israeli Declaration of Independence as a human rights document. Our colleagues in Israel have put together a study program on the Israeli Declaration of Independence to enable us as English speakers. First, they developed it in Hebrew, and then they translated the whole program into English. They developed it for an Israeli audience and to teach soldiers and school children that the Declaration of Independence really does talk about human rights in a very broad way, human rights for all citizens of Israel. And we now have this document translated into English, and it's been a terrific teaching tool for us, as I said, rabbis are teachers, for us to bring to our constituents, both adults and those who are learning as children or teens or college students, about the fact that Israel was established by visionaries who wanted to create a state that would enable Jews to live freely, really for the first time in history, to be full citizens of a state and to welcome other minorities as well. And so the idea of protection of minorities, which we struggle with here in America, was also built into by the founders of the State of Israel. So that's something else that we're going to be exploring
at the conference. Right. Now, you said that when I asked you about Netarai Karta, you said, no, they don't believe Israel should even exist. I imagine being a rabbi, part of your studies were the Torah. Is that correct?
Yes. The term Torah really means teaching.
Okay.
So Torah, in the most narrow sense, is often understood to be the Torah scroll that we take out and read every week, reading through the five books of Moses in the course of each year. But Torah, in the broadest sense, really means learning. So we could say, I want to study the Torah of my mothers and fathers. You know, those wise sayings that your grandpa passed down to you or your grandma. So the word Torah really is a very elastic and vibrant term. So I have studied, and I do, and I continue to study on a weekly basis, if not a daily basis, five books of Moses and the full Hebrew Bible. And I study many, many other sources of wisdom as well. And for many of us, Torah, as I said, not only includes the informal teachings of our own family, but many of us consider the writings of contemporary philosophers and historians and novelists to become part of our Torah as well. Former rabbi, I have a very open-hearted and hopefully open-minded view of what truth and wisdom can be.
And what's the difference between Torah and Talmud?
The Torah is the law that was originally verbal, that was originally oral, and the Talmud was written down by the rabbis around the time of Jesus and codified in about the 2nd century, and it is a wonderfully rich compilation of discussions between rabbis, often jumping off of what folks know as the Hebrew Bible, or sometimes called the Old Testament, although we don't use that phrase, because for us there is no New Testament, it is the Testament. And we prefer the term Hebrew Bible. The Talmud is a compilation of writings and argumentation and discussion. It's often described as the Sea of Talmud because it's so rich. And you dive in and you get to know the different personalities and how they're speaking to one another. And part of the fun is that the rabbis speak to one another across the generations. So one can have a very lively conversation with someone who has been dead for hundreds of years. And that's one of the great pleasures for those of us who study Judaism, is that we're always engaged in a conversation with somebody, and it's the conversation is as alive now as it might have been in the year 200, and here we are beyond the year 2000. So we keep those conversations alive, and I believe that we continue to add to them and enrich our study. The Talmud is pretty much a closed book now. I mean, there are printed versions of the Talmud that we study. They keep us both intellectually and spiritually alive.
But the Talmud is a part of rabbinical teachings then, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Netarai Karta, obviously, they're basing their beliefs on their studies, the Torah, perhaps the Talmud, I don't know. And they say it's clear in the Torah that Israel can't exist. Is there any truth in what they're saying?
Well, it's not that Israel can't exist. Israel exists. Israel is really the name of the people. What they're saying is there should not be a modern state. There should not be a modern polity. But they call themselves, as do all Jews, B'nai Yisrael, the children of Israel. Israel is the name that Jacob receives in the Bible when he wrestles with this mysterious force at night. Is it an angel? Is it the Holy One? We don't know. We do know that Jacob's name is changed to Israel, so that then all Jews henceforth become the children of Israel, or B'nai Yisrael. So the term Israel is both the people, and it also was chosen to be the name of the modern state that was established in 1948. So there are those who don't think that we should have a state, that Jews should not have a state, that we should not be a polity in the way that was established 62 years ago. They are in a minority among the Jewish people. And ironically, where do they live? They live in the modern state of Israel, because that's a place where they can live in full freedom and acceptance. But they don't take advantage in the way that you and I hopefully take advantage of our civic rights as citizens in the country in which we live.
So what they believe to be what the Torah says, that the state of Zionism is antithetical to the Torah, there's really not much.
Yes, this is a small group of ultra-Orthodox Jews, and there are many different kinds of folks who describe themselves as Orthodox or Haredi or observant. There are many ways that we define ourselves as part of the Jewish people.
Okay. Ultimately, is there some truth in what they're saying?
For them.
So it's not clear-cut that the teachings of the Torah, what they believe is
not
that...
Not at all.
Okay, not at all.
Those of us who follow a particular text have many ways of interpreting it, and there are always going to be many opinions. As I mentioned, that the Talmud is a book that is all about opinions, and Jews love to argue, and this is just one of the many arguments that some Jews have with other Jews.
Speaking about the State of Israel, how does the State of Israel receive your organization? Are you considered to be anti-Semitic or some of the other terms that might be flung about because of your human rights work?
The term anti-Semitism is an odd term because both Jews and Arabs, by some, are considered to be Semites. So can a Jew be an anti-Semite? That's an interesting question. We in Rabbis for Human Rights ideally would like every rabbi in the State of Israel to be a part of our organization, because we believe that it's very clear that our texts turn us to be engaged with the world through what we would call a human rights lens. But like many things, we're continuing to bring folks along with us on our various projects and campaigns, both in Israel and in America. Likewise, I wish that all American rabbis would embrace Rabbis for Human Rights North America. But like everything else, we reach out to many, and some are interested and become committed and join us in our work, and others decide for whatever their own reasons are, that they're not going to join us. But among many, there is great respect for this organization and for the risk that individuals take on a regular basis in Israel, particularly. We are not taking the kinds of risks because we don't live in a culture and a country in a situation that is as dangerous. It's different for us, but nevertheless, we're all working together to make our values be real in a world that needs clear vision and moral clarity.
So you haven't been attacked at all by the State of Israel for your ideas or for what you're trying to accomplish then?
There are individuals in Israel who aren't crazy about the work that Rabbis for Human Rights does. It's a progressive organization that is underscoring the human rights of Palestinians and particularly of Arab citizens of the State of Israel who are too often underserved by the government. Particularly, we've been involved in attempting to prevent house demolitions in Israel. That's been one of our big projects there, where folks who live in Arab communities have not been able to procure appropriate permits to either to build onto their home or to build their home in the first place. The Israeli government, particularly the Jerusalem municipality, has then knocked down those homes, has demolished those homes because they are built without a permit. I mean, and you can make the analogy to anything in America as well, for safety reasons, et cetera, but if you can't obtain the permit, what do you do? How do you live? So that's one of our projects. Another project has been supporting and participating in the olive harvest. Wonderful irony. What is the symbol of peace? The olive branch.
Right.
For many, many centuries. So too often, Arab farmers have been prevented from completing their harvest, partly because of the separation barrier that has been erected around Jerusalem, and not just around Jerusalem, but on the West Bank. And so Jewish volunteers, rabbis, and friends have gone to help with the olive harvest. So those are just two examples, and you can imagine that there are folks who don't agree with that. Whenever we stick our neck out in the world to try and do the right thing, there are those who disagree with us. So sometimes we go back and study and see, okay, why did we take this stance, and how do we want to modify the way we're behaving and interacting with others, and how do we want to go forward to do what is just and right?
Sue, the good people over at Jewish Voice for Peace sent an email out apprising me of the conference that's going to take place in 2 days. I guess it's on December 5th, 6th, and 7th in New York City, Rabbis for Human Rights North America, and it's titled Human Rights Under Fire, A Jewish Call to Action. Tell our listeners about that conference, please.
We are very excited to be presenting this conference. This is our third conference on Judaism and human rights. Every 2 years, we brought together individuals from across North America, and we've always had folks come in from Israel for this conference as well, so that we can learn more about what we as Jews need to be doing in the world to make our values real and to apply our values and our spiritual commitment to our work in the world. So this year, we're having the conference in New York. We're beginning by presenting the third Lemkin Award. The Lemkin Award is named after Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term genocide. He was a human rights activist and helped focus the world's attention on the fact that too often in history, entire peoples have been targeted by others for reasons that at the end of the day don't really make any sense, of course. And so we have looked to human rights activists to honor them and to bring them to the attention of the wider community. We're calling this Courage, Voice, and Vision. The Human Rights Awards will be awarded on Sunday to Nomi Chazan, who is with the New Israel Fund. In many ways, it's been her work that inspired the name for this conference, Human Rights Under Fire, because she, as a very visionary, progressive leader, she's a professor, she's a feminist, she's been a human rights activist for her entire career as an Israeli thinker and politician. Her work most recently with the New Israel Fund indeed came under fire this year, and she was demonized by many on the right for her work. And we want to support her. We do support her. We're delighted that we're able to award her the Lemkin Award this year. And she's also one of our speakers for the conference. And our other awardee is Ari Nair, who is the president of the Open Society Initiative. And their work is known across the world for supporting indigenous individuals and communities. So we feel very happy to be able to bring these two really exemplary individuals to the fore and than to say more of us need to be like them. It's great to have heroes, and we live in a world with too few. So that's how we begin our conference, and then we have an opening plenary, Human Rights Under Fire in the Age of Obama and Netanyahu, so that we say right at the beginning that we're looking both at America and at the State of Israel, and looking at what's working and what's not working, particularly why human rights activists are often overlooked and the issues that we care about are not brought to the fore. We have a second plenary on indefinite detention. How long before indefinite detention without charge becomes permanent betrayal of our values? Why are people being held in prisons without having the opportunity to consult with counsel and to move their trials along? We've seen much too much of this in America, and it's not over. We had so many hopes when Obama was elected, and as you know, it's been more challenging to move through his administration than anyone, including him, expected. We then are having a plenary on slavery, trafficking, and people of faith in our own backyards and beyond. There was a piece about this. Nick Kristof wrote about this in the New York Times last week. It's a very timely issue that trafficking of humans, particularly women, is rampant right here in America. And it's happening in your town and mine, right under our noses. And we need to bring those of us who are people of faith to acknowledge that this is a serious issue and to ask what we can do about it in our communities and in our schools and our places of work and so on. And then our final plenary is on Israel exceptionalism, human rights, and the road ahead. We're asking serious questions about whether we make exceptions for Israel because we are Zionists and we are committed to the existence of the State of Israel. And we do not want to be turning our backs on our beloved state, especially when we are not living up to, as I mentioned, the Declaration of Independence of that state. We're also having a briefing on the crisis on Islamophobia that erupted around the Park 51 property where an Islamic community center is to be built in New York City.
Ground Zero Mosque.
Yes, the so-called Ground Zero Mosque.
Exactly.
It's neither at Ground Zero, nor is it a mosque. So we, as Jews, totally understand the need for and the wonderful function of a Jewish community center. And so an Islamic community center would provide the same kind of options for our Muslim brothers and sisters. And we're going to hear from a number of folks who've been involved in that project, which will expand our understanding and help us to identify some of the human rights issues that came up there. Those are the big sessions that we'll be having together. And then we have many terrific breakout sessions, that many of which will enable participants really both to speak to one another, to learn from one another, and also to talk about where do we go from here? How do we take this home? How do I, as a rabbi, or I, as a lay leader in a congregation or as part of a community, bring home what I've learned about these big issues, but really to say human rights matters for us on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, on a yearly basis? How do we use our holidays, for instance, to focus on human rights issues? Of course, we're going to celebrate, but Americans just celebrated Thanksgiving, and some folks were asking very good questions about the rights of immigrants. I mean, we celebrate the pilgrims who came here and started this country, so to speak, and what was their relationship with those who were already living here? For those of us who say there's human rights questions in every holiday, as I would say, we could start as an American with Thanksgiving, and for us as Jews, we have questions about how do we fold in our increasing knowledge and understanding of ourselves as citizens of the world into our passion and love for our particular tradition.
And just let me digress a bit. You were talking about the slavery issue. Does Israel have a history with human trafficking?
Unfortunately, I wouldn't say that the State of Israel has a history. Unfortunately, the reality is that there have been women brought to Israel as prostitutes, and it's being dealt with. There are a number of organizations that are facing it, but I wish I could tell you it didn't exist.
Is it a big problem there, relative to the other countries?
Israel is a first world country. It's a country where there is not an enormous percentage of people living in poverty. People have, for the most part, running water and so on. We have to be careful of when we compare countries. We would have to look at per capita, Sweden versus Israel,
right,
the U.S. versus Israel, Italy versus Israel. When it's your country, it's a problem, whether it's thousands or hundreds of individuals affected. We don't want anyone affected by this kind of plague. And we as Jews are particularly sensitive to slavery. We celebrate Passover every year, and one of the songs we sing, part of our liturgy, is "We were slaves, now we are free," because we are remembering the historic and the story of being slaves in Egypt. But for Jews, it's the fact that anyone can be enslaved at any time in history, and that as Jews, it's our responsibility to open our eyes to the slavery that may be happening right next door to us.
Mm-hmm.
One of the unique things about Rabbis for Human Rights is that we talk about these difficult, painful, embarrassing, shameful issues. But if we don't speak about them, we will never be able to address them and to face them and to improve the lot of those who are afflicted and oppressed.
It's a great thing you're doing. The conference, Rabbis for Human Rights North America, so let me give some websites here. Well, your website is www.urj.org, that's urj.org, and the website for Rabbis for Human Rights North America is www.rhr-na.org. You cannot register online anymore for the conference, and registration will be available at the conference facility. Those are the websites. The conference starts on the 5th. What time does it start, Sue?
We begin at 2:30 on Sunday afternoon with the Lemkin Award ceremony.
Oh, you're going to go right into that award ceremony.
Yes, that's the first thing.
Oh, that's great. Okay. And the address is?
The conference is being held at two sites. On Sunday, December 5th, the conference is being held at B'nai Jeshurun Synagogue. It's at 257 West 88th Street between Broadway and West End Avenues in New York City on the Upper West Side. And on Monday and Tuesday, the conference is being held at the Conference Center, and the address there is 130 East 59th Street.
Mm-hmm. In between Park and Lexington. Okay. And, of course, there's a sliding scale for the cost of the conference. And anything else you want to tell our listeners about it?
We would love to have anyone who's interested in our work join us.
Okay. And you have an affiliation with Jewish Voice for Peace?
We're a partner organization. So there are a number of organizations that are partnering with us, and Jewish Voice for Peace is one of them.
The third North American Conference on Judaism and Human Rights, Human Rights Under Fire, A Jewish Call to Action. You cannot register online, but you can register right at the conference. And as Rabbi Elwell said, as Sue said, there are two locations. It begins December 5th at 2:30, right with the award ceremony, the Lemkin Award ceremony. And it closes out on the 7th of December. Rabbi Elwell, Sue, I want to thank you so much for the time you took out of your busy schedule to explain all this stuff to our listeners. You're doing a great thing. I wish you the best of luck, and thanks again for all the time you spent with us.
Well, thank you very much.